Hey, everyone, heads up. I want to tell you about the brand new NPR podcast, Hidden Brain. It's about social science you can apply throughout your life. You can get a preview of Shankar Vedantam's Hidden Brain beginning September 4th. You'll hear professional poker player Annie Duke tell Shankar how she weaponized stereotypes to her advantage. Find the Hidden Brain podcast at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app. From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Your identity is who you are. And sometimes that's based on status.
It was so strange because I knew that this was going to change my immigration status. But it was like a direct result of being abused, and it didn't feel like something I wanted to celebrate.
Other times, it's based on where you're from.
I'd always assumed that our family had some Native American blood. How could we not, after so many centuries in the Southwest?
Today, stories of identity, from an immigration activist redefining herself to a family who had to rewrite their story thanks to genetic testing. Plus, Latino Muslims, Latino Goths, and how identity affects your travels. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome to Latino USA, everyone. I'm Maria Hinojosa.
Lacking papers, lacking documentation, feelings of guilt because of my...
Since she publicly revealed her immigration status in 2010, Angie Rivera has been outspoken about being undocumented and unafraid.
Crushing all these chains, stating I am undocumented and unafraid. I want to celebrate our victory, not sorry. And yes, I will own my story.
This is Angie at the annual Coming Out of the Shadows rally in New York City. She's standing in a park with a megaphone in her hand. A yellow banner with the words undocumented and unafraid hangs behind her. All of the immigration activists that day used their identity as a tool, as a way to put a human face to an issue that it seems, once again, is becoming more and more contentious. And identity is what today's show is all about. How people choose to identify themselves and what that means for them in their everyday lives. The first Coming Out of the Shadows rally was organized by Angie and her fellow immigrant rights activists in 2010. In fact, 2010 was a pivotal year. The DREAM Act, intended to allow undocumented youth a path to citizenship, was all over the news.
The House of Representatives is debating and voting on the DREAM Act this evening.
Congress to pass the so-called DREAM Act, which would allow pathway to citizenship.
Critics say the DREAM Act amounts to amnesty for illegals.
Almost a decade after being introduced, it seemed like it had the votes to pass in the House and the Senate. For Angie, the DREAM Act was a big deal. It would mean that she could finally apply for financial aid and have access to the education she wanted. So, protesting and organizing for immigrant rights, specifically the DREAM Act, became Angie's entire life. She was a member of the New York State Youth Leadership Council, a group that helped her start the very first undocumented advice column, Ask Angie.
There are many frustrating things about being undocumented.
Angie would take questions from people online and then answer them on her YouTube channel. And the questions weren't just technical ones about politics or paperwork.
There's always these different kinds of relationships while being undocumented. One, there's the one where you don't want to tell them you're undocumented because you feel like that doesn't define you. That's not who you are. They shouldn't.
The ones that kind of stuck out for me were about the boyfriend. Like, do I tell my boyfriend or not?
Yeah.
When you started to get those questions, what did you think?
I was really impacted by those kinds of questions. We focus so much on the legislation and the adjustment of status that we forget about what it means to live undocumented every day and all the experiences that come with that, from dating to picking up a package or having to be ID'd if you go to a bar or a club. You know, those are things that happen all the time that we don't really talk about because we're focused on the legislation.
Being so public and talking about her own personal story empowered Angie. But when the DREAM Act was defeated in December of 2010, Angie found other creative ways to pay for college. That included selling friendship bracelets online. And she continued to participate in protests and to put out Ask Angie videos.
Hi, everyone. I'm not sure if you've heard about this policy called Deferred Action, which would stop the deportation of some youth and would grant them work authorization, a social security number, and as well as a driver's license here in the state of New York, at least. I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of the fears that have come up when thinking about applying for Deferred Action.
In 2013, filmmaker Michaela Schwer reached out to Angie. She was interested in possibly making a documentary about her. Michaela had been amazed that Angie was able to be so public about her very personal story.
I don't understand why someone isn't coming for Angie if she's being so public about this.
Why hadn't authorities shown up at Angie's or other dreamers' doors to deport them? It turns out there's safety in being public about your status.
Now that, you know, this voice is out there, she's got people that will fight for her and protect her in a certain way. She's got lawyers on her side. And she's able to, you know, the entire community is really able to rally people around them.
Angie agreed to be filmed for the documentary, which is called No Le Digas a Nadie, or Don't Tell Anyone. It airs in late September on PBS as part of their POV series. And even though Angie has been so open about her personal life, this documentary manages to dive even deeper. It shows her at home, dancing with her mom.
Baila con... Tú me guías.
Qué perdida.
Going to poetry readings.
Looking around nervously, wondering who else knows. ¿Será que alguien se da cuenta? Can everyone see?
Like, and it even shows meetings with her immigration lawyer.
Okay, let's start at the beginning.
Yeah, I found this report card. Okay. When I was 8, I think.
The documentary is an opportunity, Michaela says, to show the human side of immigration.
You can see, you know, activism in the news and you can see certain stories, but to get to a deeper level and get to know Angie and her family, for me personally, as a director, I felt like if you can get to know Angie, and how can you not feel for her and love her in the same way that I did as getting to know her as a director, I wanted to relay that to a bigger audience.
Michaela decided to film Angie because she was curious about Angie as a person, not knowing where the story would take them. Neither she nor Angie anticipated the big change that would occur in Angie's life just months into filming. Angie had applied for a kind of visa called a U visa, but she wasn't expecting much.
When I applied for my U visa, I kind of just forgot about it. You know, it was in the back of my mind because I was still going to school and working, so it wasn't on my mind the whole time. And when my attorney called me, it was Thanksgiving break, and she called me to tell me I got the U visa. And, you know, obviously, she was really happy because this was, like, a great thing, right? And it kind of just hits you in full force. But it's complicated because of all the stuff that comes with.
It's complicated because the U visa is a very particular kind of visa. It's only given to victims of crimes who have suffered mental or physical abuse and who have helped law enforcement in the investigation. Angie had been a victim of a crime.
I had been sexually assaulted when I was younger, and I just started thinking about the abuse, and the application process had already made me feel really sad. I had to recount a lot of things and reread a lot of things that maybe brought up stuff, so it wasn't an easy process to apply.
Angie had been open about her assault.
I decided to share it publicly around 2012. I was still dealing with a lot of the shame and the stigma that comes with being assaulted and what that means for you and for your family. So I wanted to address it and be at a better place.
For Angie, her identity wasn't defined by being an assault victim. To her, it was one of the many issues she had to fight for alongside immigration reform.
The immigrant rights movement wasn't really talking about it. We weren't really connecting the dots with other issues. We weren't talking about sexual assault in the immigrant community and what that was like. And so I shared.
But even being as open as she's been about her experience, Angie still had conflicted feelings about the U visa. Can you tell us what those emotions were? when you actually got that U visa and you actually didn't look incredibly happy. And then actually you started crying.
Yeah.
What was going on? What happened at that moment for you?
I'm probably going to need the tissues for real now.
That's okay.
It was so strange because I knew that this was going to change my immigration status. But it was like a direct result of being abused, and it didn't feel like something I wanted to celebrate. And I couldn't even if I tried. So it was really complicated. I don't know. That's not how I imagined it to be. And when, at least for me, like, when you're assaulted, it's not something that you want to think about all the time.
And that's part of the problem with being Ask Angie. You get asked things all the time.
And when people ask me, you know, like, oh, did you apply? How are you going to get a green card? How are you going to get papers? I have no other choice but to tell them, well, I have a U visa. How did you get a U visa? I was a victim of a crime. Well, what happened? And it always goes back to that.
Angie's ambivalence can rub some people the wrong way.
So I've gotten the you're very lucky, or some people were frustrated with me because I wasn't as happy as they thought I should be. So some people have called me ungrateful and just said, you know, this is a great opportunity for you. Why are you so ungrateful?
But Angie's been fighting for her citizenship for a long time, and she hoped she could get legal status some other way.
And there's a moment in the film where you say, you know what, so I don't understand. So all of my hard work, getting all the good grades, going to school all the time, you know, participating in my community, all of that wasn't enough to get me to a path to legalization, to regularize your situation. None of that mattered, except for the fact that you had been sexually assaulted.
Yeah, and that's what the application looked like. I had to get a lot of proof that I had been assaulted and proof that it impacted me and proof that I collaborated with law enforcement. I didn't have to show my report card or my transcripts from college. None of that really mattered.
Angie continues to dedicate her life to helping other undocumented people live their day-to-day lives. But now that she's documented, has her day-to-day life changed? Less than you'd expect.
I kind of still walk the same, and I sometimes forget that I have a U visa. I know that sounds silly, but like if I see officers in the street, I'm still like conscious that they're there, and that's always something that I've had with me before. I now have a state ID, so I can use that when I try to get into places or use it to identify myself, and it's easier than using my Colombian passport. It's different because it changes your immigration status, but it doesn't change everything else, you know? Like, my family still struggles to make ends meet, and it's not like, you know, in snap of a finger, you just got this whole new life. You're kind of still, you're still you. You just have, like, a visa.
Thanks to Angie and Michaela for speaking with us. And to learn more about Angie and her journey, tune into your local PBS channel on September 21st and catch No Le Digas a Nadie, or Don't Tell Anyone. And coming up on Latino USA?
I just got all this, like, negative attention anyway. So I decided to kind of own that by becoming this, like, kind of terrifying girl.
We hear from some former goths. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Albóndiga, ojalá, ajedrez. Yes, these are all Spanish words, but they come out of the intersection between the Spanish and Muslim worlds. It's an intersection where some Latinos live, where their identity lies. As part of our series of conversations on Latinos and identity, Somos, who we are, I spoke with three Latino Muslims. Hazel Gomez is a community organizer who focuses on immigration and criminal justice reform. Hamza Perez is a rapper, activist, and the subject of the 2009 documentary, The New Muslim Cool. And Wilfredo Amor-Ruiz is an attorney, political activist, and a Muslim chaplain. Thanks for joining us, everyone, and assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Hi, thank you so much for letting me be here.
¿Cómo está, María?
All right, so let's start at the beginning. The question, of course, is even though there's this centuries-long relationship between Latin America and the Arab world, it all comes down to individual experiences. So I want to find out how you, Hazel, came to intersect with Islam. Tell us your story briefly.
Sure. I first met the first Muslim when I was 14, freshman year, first day in high school, first period. I looked at her and I said, "You're kind of confusing me. You look Hindu, but you're dressed like a nun, but where's your dot?" And she just started laughing and she said, "I'm actually Muslim." I had no idea what that meant. And that was really my first exposure to Islam, just becoming friends with her and seeing the different things that she did. One of the first things that really drew me to Islam was there was a time where Lent and Ramadan were happening at the same time. And I remember vividly that I was fasting and my friends were fasting as well, but our experiences were just so different. And I just remember seeing them in the library, reading Quran and praying. And I just remember thinking, wow, how come I can't get that spiritual high? So I became Muslim eventually when I was 18, my senior year in high school. But it was a very social experience for me until that one moment where Ramadan and Lent were at the same time. And I'll never forget it. It was just really transformative for me.
What about you, Hamza? What was your experience in terms of intersecting and finding Islam in your own life?
Well, you know, I came from a real rough background. My family belonged to a gang in Brooklyn called the Turban Saints. And growing up, I tried many things to try to taste happiness. You know, getting money, getting high, partying, having fun. And none of these things would quench the thirst of happiness that I was actually looking for. And one day, while I was standing in the middle of the street, and I was there with some friends, and we were drinking, we were smoking, and I saw my friend, who happened to be a Latin King member, and he looked like a transformed human being. And he looked like he finally tasted happiness. And I ended up embracing Islam right in the middle of the street just from looking at him.
So what does that mean when you say, "I ended up choosing Islam in the middle of a street"?
You know, how someone becomes Muslim is real easy. It's not like they have to get dunked in the sand and wear a thing on their head and ride a camel around in a circle. They just have to believe that there's only one God and that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is one of the messengers of God.
Hazel's and Hamza's experience involved people, interaction with another Muslim. But in my case, I have twins, Piero and Angeles, they are now like 14. Back then, they were like 2 years old. And I used to have this recurrent conversation with their mother about, hey, we should revisit a church, we should raise our kids in an ethical environment where God is part of the conversation. One of those days, I was driving to our mother's houses in Puerto Rico, and I was driving next to an Islamic center, like in the suburbs of San Juan. And I looked at the Islamic center and I told her, "You know what? I'm going to find out about Islam." And we were quiet like for a few seconds. And the first reaction was that we both laughed. And we were even joking about, hey, could you imagine our backyard with tents? And you with a turban and camels in the back in our backyard, and we were all laughing about it. So when we went arrive our her mother's house, she said, "You know what? A few days ago, I went to a Palestinian's store, and he gave me this pamphlet. That pamphlet had the addresses and phone numbers of the Islamic centers in Puerto Rico, and I started to visit them after listening to." The concept of God in Islam, it wasn't any different to what I have always believed naturally of who God was.
So the first thing that that I thought of, you know, is that reaction when you come home, also having been raised in a pretty traditional Catholic home, though non-practicing. But I can imagine what would have happened in my own home if I would have come home and said, Mami, Papi, you know, me volví musulmana. You know, I became a Muslim. And they probably would have said, like, and what? What?
Maria, to me, it was shocking because my mother was a Eucharistic minister. The way she reacted is that she wouldn't speak to me for months. And I wondered if she ever heard that I was doing drugs or drinking alcohol, she wouldn't stop talking to me or addressing me for months. But when she learned I was a Muslim, she wouldn't talk to me for months.
My whole journey was like a two-year process. And I didn't convert because I kept thinking what my family would say. I put my grandma and my grandpa in a room, and I said, Mama, Papa, I became Muslim today. And my grandfather just starts bawling his eyes out. My grandmother is infuriated. Estaba rabiosa. She leaves the room, and she's like, how dare you? How dare you leave Catholicism? How dare you not believe in God anymore? And I was like, what, Mama? Like, that's the complete opposite. And one of the beauties about taking the Shahada, as Hermano Hamza said, is all you have to say is, I believe that there is one God, and I believe in the Prophet Muhammad. And I said that day that I converted. But what really struck me was when the scholar said, and I also believe in the Prophet Jesus and the Virgin Mary. So for me, when I said my Shahada, my declaration of faith, and he added that, it was powerful because I finally felt like I believed in them the right way. I believed in the Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, and the Virgin Mary. So for me to like tell that to my grandparents in that moment, it was just, you know, in one ear, not the other. They just didn't want to hear it.
Was the experience for you, Hamza, different because of the fact that you had, you know, you had been struggling, you were selling drugs, you were doing drugs? Was the experience like, se salvó? You know, he found his path. Thank God that he found the God of Islam.
Yeah, people were just in state of shock. Like, just we went from selling drugs to walking down the street, you know, dressed in like what they thought was dresses. After my friend became Muslim and I became Muslim, another friend of mine became Muslim. Over 55 people from my neighborhood became Muslim. And people were saying, what's going on? Mira, ¿qué le pasa a Jason? Because my government name is Jason. And my mom be like, mija, déjalo quieto. Tiene un traje. He looks like an Arab, but I see him praying all the time, you know. And it was a big shock for the people in the neighborhood.
But you know what? Maria, I have found that most of us go through a three-stage process. The first one being an initial rejection, then to an it's okay time frame. And then it evolved to people being sympathetic to you. Like my mother's initial, I'm not going to talk to him for some months, it transformed to even in Christmas, me receiving as a gift, a praying rug.
So the perception is that Islam is an experience that is going to be somewhat limiting. Probably the conventional wisdom is you become somewhat restrained, you know, there is a modesty, there is the, you know, not necessarily touching other people, the head covering. And, you know, the perception among Latinos is that we're very open. So put these two, you know, perceptions, whether or not they're true or not, put them together in terms of how they become a reality in terms of your lives.
I can say that a lot of those things are passionate things that have to do with our passions. And perhaps people who don't know how to control themselves are prisoners to their passions. And they're only limited what their passions command them to do. In Islam, we become free by controlling our passions and not becoming slaves and prisoners to what our passions command us to do. So it depends how you look at it.
We just discover a whole new world on how to exchange with our friends, with our families. You can really feel happy without introducing alcohol to a party. And that is something that in our culture, we are only taught that, hey, if there's no alcohol in a party, there's really not a party.
Being a Latina and a Muslim is not a dichotomy. And that needs to be something that everybody understands. Unfortunately, we live in a society where Latinos have a particular stereotype, right? We're all gangbangers. We're all drug dealers. We all have babies by the time we're 16. And that is such a disgusting stereotype that the media really portrays of our people.
To all three of you, I say shukran. Thanks for joining us on Latino USA for the beginning, I think, of a pretty wonderful conversation.
Muchas gracias.
Blessings.
Thank you.
Stay in peace.
Hazel Gomez joined us from WDET in Detroit, Michigan. Hamza Perez was at WESA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And Wilfredo Amor-Ruiz was in the studio at WLRN in Miami. So Hazel spoke about facing stereotypes. And people don't just face stereotypes for being Latino or Muslim. Sometimes it's because of what you're into or how you dress, how you choose to show the world who you are. Like if you're a goth. Yeah, a goth, as in the subculture known for black clothing and heavy emotive music. So now we hear from three Latinos, Pablo Pofald, Susie Exposito, and Nadia Raymond, who all took goth as an identity at some point in their lives.
My name is Pablo. I'm 31 years old. I am from Indiana in a small town, but my parents are from Chile, and I now live in Salt Lake City, Utah. I would say I definitely grew up feeling fairly, individualistic and different from the people around me, especially growing up in a small Midwestern town. I think as I got older, I was definitely more attracted to subcultures that felt like they were sort of embracing of either different political views or different aesthetics or something that just sort of felt a little bit different than what I felt to be mainstream style or music or, you know, art and such. You know, I started exploring things and, you know, got really interested in Nine Inch Nails. What you deserve, bow down before the one you serve. Through him, I got drawn into, you know, larger pockets of industrial music and electronic music in general, and, you know, started wearing black because I thought it looked cool and I liked the aesthetic in general and combat boots and things like that, colored hair, all that sort of stuff. It felt like different from quote unquote mainstream culture in the sense that the majority, you know, of people around me were not necessarily wearing lots of black and listening to super dark music. But at the same time, there were quite a few kids that were. So it wasn't necessarily that I felt like I was into something so different from everybody else, but it did feel like I had discovered a style and aesthetic and music that really appealed to me and my personality and, you know, felt good.
My name is Susie Exposito, and I'm a former mall goth. I would describe a mall goth as a young person who might go to the mall for no other reason besides terrifying all the people who go to the mall who are not goths. I was bullied for a variety of things. Like, I was like the shortest kid in class. I also got made fun of for like having really thick eyebrows. And I just got all this like negative attention anyway. So I decided to kind of own that by becoming this like kind of terrifying girl. It started with music, really. My parents really liked Nirvana, but also they really liked Depeche Mode and The Cure and Morrissey. And apparently, according to a lot of my other Latino friends, that's actually really common. Like, for whatever reason, Latinos love Morrissey, and nobody really knows why. I think it's the melodrama. You have killed me, you have killed me. Yes, I walk around. I just listened to what my parents listened to, and now I'm really proud of the way that I pulled off being goth and being Latina. I basically reinterpreted chonga fashion in a really goth way. So I like to call myself a chongoth in that time period. Because I had like this dark brown lipstick. I plucked my eyebrows really, really thin and kind of like drew them on. And now I'm really proud of that. I'm glad that I didn't completely succumb to my peers who just insisted that I was too ghetto and too ethnic to be a goth.
My name is Nadia Raymond. I am Latino USA's music consultant. You usually don't hear me, but if you hear music, and especially if you hear music and you like it, then you hear me. Why do Latinos love Morrissey? This is a question that has troubled the ages since the beginning of time. I don't really know why we love Morrissey. I think it's partially a combination of the extreme earnestness of Morrissey is kind of like similar to like mariachi lyrics. Like there's a lot of like heartache and opening your veins and spilling your blood to show the person that you would rather die than be without them, like that type of thing. I think that appeals to our some like part of our brain that grew up listening to that in the background. I also just think that we all like the pompadour. It's just very much an awesome fashion statement that we can all relate to. Rock music in general at that time in Latin America was really popular because I think rock music sounds to us and has similar beats and similar structure to a lot of just a combination of African musical roots that we all have because of slavery and because of immigration. And it also has lyrical bases that are very like emotional, heartfelt music, even when sung with like a heavy beat. So there's always like, you know, a physical manifestation of all these cultural tastes. I think that for goth kids, it just happened to be a way for them to be able to self-identify and let other kids that share those cultural tastes see them and find community that way.
Nadia makes some very good points about why Latinos love Morrissey, but I don't know that any of us will ever be satisfied with the answer. Just have to experience it, I guess. And coming up on Latino USA, when identities collide in the classroom.
How many times have you been kicked out or disciplined for disagreeing with teachers over race?
Sally, I can't even count.
Stay with us. No se vayan. Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. So before we get back to this episode on identity, I wanted to ask you to do me a favor. Take a moment to rate and review Latino USA on iTunes. I know that many of you have, and it's really been a big help. But for those of you who haven't, if you could, we would really appreciate it. And if you can, please help us to continue to bring you the work that you love by going to latinousa.org and clicking on the donate button. Every little bit helps, mi gente. Thanks so much.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Walton Family Foundation, working to prepare all students for a lifetime of opportunities by ensuring access to high-quality K-12 choices. More information is available at waltonk12.org. And the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're talking about identity and how that plays out in our lives. Now, almost half of American public school students are kids of color, but more than 80% of the teachers are white. That's according to the Center for American Progress. And sometimes these differences in who we are affect the dynamic in the classroom. Reporter Yo-Wei Shaw brings us this story from Philadelphia.
Victor Jackson is over writing about U.S. presidents, especially the slave owner Thomas Jefferson. So when Victor's seventh-grade teacher asked him to write about a president, he said no.
I was like, if I write this paper, you're going to be upset.
Instead, he asked his teacher if he could write about Huey Newton.
And she's asking me, who is Huey Newton? I was like...
Victor told her he helped found the Black Panther Party.
And she was just like... Is that like a basketball team?
Victor ended up not writing about either Thomas Jefferson or Huey Newton.
She changed the assignment and we wrote about pierogies.
Pierogies, as in the Eastern European dumplings. Imani Rothwell also has stories.
In sixth grade, during Black History Month, I had this teacher and we were on the topic of slavery. And she tried to paint it as this thing that just happened is like, oh, slavery happened, but let's move on. And I was like, no, that's not how we're going to do it. And then she had the nerve to ask me, was I raised by wolves? Because I decided to correct her.
Imani walked out of the classroom and got a detention.
How many times have you been kicked out or disciplined for disagreeing with teachers over race?
Sadly, I can't even count.
Imani's a tough cookie, but even she would break at times.
I wouldn't deny that. Late at night, I would cry because I felt so frustrated. You know how you feel you can't do anything when you feel powerless? I think it's the worst feeling in the world.
Some students say their teachers stereotype them, misinterpret their culture, or completely avoid the subject of race. This year, the U.S. Department of Education's Civil Rights Office reported that students of color face a disproportionate number of suspensions and expulsions.
Well, I think when students feel that they're not a part of the classroom, and in fact that it is openly hostile to them, then they do a couple things. They can either withdraw, so they just don't participate, or they act out.
That's Gloria Ladson-Billings at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. For years, she's been fighting to make classrooms more culturally relevant. She even coined the term. Ladson-Billings says that typically, teacher prep programs only require one cultural competency course, and that teacher educators are overwhelmingly white. But the point isn't to blame teachers.
Remember that teachers are not outside of the society. They receive the same messages we all receive. Via media, via their own, quote, experiences or lack thereof. So they are doing their best to, quote, catch up with some stuff.
In Philadelphia, a grassroots organization called Teacher Action Group is trying to do just that. Like here, at John P. Stetson Charter School.
I'm really glad Mr. Wilson's here!
He didn't read the readings, but that's okay!
A group of teachers meets every 2 weeks to discuss the teacher education book, Rethinking Multicultural Education. Fifth grade teacher Elizabeth Kim says the book club is a safe space.
So when you're talking about race and when you only have like your story or like, you know, the stories of people around you to base your knowledge off of, then it becomes very scary to like open it up to questions that might make you squirm. But you have to be okay with that.
The teachers talk about how to handle sensitive topics, like the legacy of Christopher Columbus, the aftermath of the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, or how to be aware of their own biases.
I, as a white woman, walk into a classroom full of almost exclusively non-white students, and like that sends messages before I even open my mouth.
That's seventh grade teacher Jamie Stevenson. She says there's no easy formula, but what's most important is understanding her students.
What their cultural background is, who they are as people interacting with one another in the world.
When a teacher finally did that with Imani Rothwell, it was huge.
I said to her, are you one of those teachers who teach Black history during Black History Month? She said, no, a real history teacher teach Black history all year round. And when she said that, I said, you are amazing. For the first time in middle school, I love going to history, and I didn't fear that this might be the day I get kicked out of class.
For Latino USA, I'm Yoe Shaw.
Thanks, Yoe, for that report. Now, there can be many difficult things that come up when you're navigating those kinds of situations. This is also true when it comes to navigating your way around the world, though maybe not in the way you'd expect. Last year, the New York Times featured an article about traveling while Black that was written by a friend of Latino USA, Farai Chidea. Farai is a novelist and a journalist. She sat down with another friend of our show, author and filmmaker Raquel Cepeda, to talk about how identity shapes their travels. Raquel kicked off the conversation by asking Farai about her motivation.
So when you aren't podcasting, reporting, lecturing, and just being your fabulous self, you do something that we share a passion for, and that's traveling. What drives you to travel, and what's your mission?
Well, for me, travel is a way to open my soul and to expand my sense of the world, because I believe I come from an intercultural family. So my father is from Zimbabwe in southern Africa, and my mother is Black American from a family, you know, my mother's family, which mainly raised me, is very into genealogy. So we trace our history back to farmers on the East Coast, you know, back several generations, and we're mixed with Scottish, and your book, of course, speaks very much to all of the different, you know, streams of humanity that go into the beings that we are today. And so when I travel, you know, I was in Paris recently talking in Franglish, you know, French, English, you know, about racism in France with a Moroccan immigrant cab driver. And that's the kind of thing that helps me understand the world, you know?
Yeah, I totally feel you there. I mean, I think we travel differently. You know, I'm reminded also of that book, Eat, Pray, Love by Elizabeth Gilbert, and where she says, you know, she talks about walking, I believe in Naples, and saying, you know, when I walk, I'm tall, I'm waspy, I turn red in the sun, and, you know, I stand out like a sore thumb. And I feel like we travel so differently. And I want you to talk about this by blending in, right?
Yep.
We blend in a way that many Americans that we perceive as being white don't. Would you agree, disagree?
Absolutely. I call it masking, where it's not as if you look exactly like a local. I mean, often I'm in a place where I'm not exactly like the people, like in southern India, where the people are the same color as me. But I remember being in Bangalore, And the only racial comment that I got, I mean, maybe people said things that I couldn't understand, and I take that as a given. But the only racial comment that I got that was not at all hostile was a guy with a young daughter in his arms, about 2 years old, says, "Look at Auntie. Auntie has beautiful hair. Look at her hair." You know, and it's like he was, you know, we were the same skin color, but I have dreadlocks. And he was just pointing out to his kid that I have dreadlocks. But it wasn't at all hostile. If anything, it was very sweet.
Wow. And how about the places where we stick out? I mean, I remember I was going to Austria and I was like, oh, God, this is going to be crazy because I know I'm going to stand out from everybody. But basically what happened there was that two things happened. One, I was either mistaken for being Turkish, yeah, or for being a Dominican prostitute.
Oh, my goodness. That's, you know, yeah, sometimes you see sides of things that are not pretty. You know, for example, in my travels throughout southern Africa, sometimes I see, for example, women being treated in ways that I completely don't appreciate. And it's not just Southern Africa, but because I have roots there, it really hurts me when I see that, when I see, you know, patriarchy manifest and writ large. And, you know, we have it in the United States, but it's different. It's particularly different if you are, for example, a rural woman who really has nowhere to turn if you don't stay with a husband who doesn't treat you with respect. And so sometimes it's, you know, it cuts close to the bone when you travel, when you also realize how much privilege you have. You know, every person of color in the United States, no matter, you know, what racial slurs we hear or what other nonsense we go through, when it comes down to it, we are still among the most privileged people in the world. And also traveling makes us realize that.
What can people of color glean from traveling that may inform them on a personal level, maybe even a spiritual level?
Depending on where you go, you realize that, you know, most of the world is, you know, brownish one way or the other. You know, even our maps are not accurate. Our maps show the Americas and Europe as larger in proportion to the rest of the world than they are. So even things like map making have become very politicized. And so we don't have to accept a lot of the narratives that we get in American society about self-worth. I think that America in general, you know, and part of this is how we view achievement and financial success. But America in general, I believe, produces people who are less happy than our material circumstances would indicate, because nothing is ever enough. Like, if you have the BMW, why don't you have the fancier BMW? At some point, you have to accept that whatever your life is, you can certainly change your life, but that your life really is, if you're living in this country, probably among the most materially rich lives in the world. And so, first of all, it can give you a sense of grounding in that way, but also you can realize that you are part of a legacy of people from different diasporas, you know, the crossroads of cultures that have brought you to this place in this time. So as an African American, going to Africa gives me that. But I also, meeting Afro-Latinos in my travels throughout, you know, Central and Latin America, has also given me another perspective. Seeing what we call otherness makes you find the connections between the other and the self, and then consequently yourself gets stronger. Yourself becomes more grounded.
That was Farai Chidea and Raquel Cepeda. Farai Chidea is an author and journalist. She's currently a columnist and consulting editor at The Intercept. And Raquel Cepeda is a filmmaker and journalist. She's also the co-host of the podcast About Race. Thanks to Farai and Raquel for their conversation. Travel can show you so much about yourself, but other people use more scientific methods. So as we wrap up today's show about identity, we turn to writer April Salazar for some sabiduría, or words of wisdom. She shares a story with us about how getting genetic testing affected her family's understanding of their identity. Here's April Salazar.
What are you? That's a question I get a lot. I have black hair and freckles. The short answer is that I'm half Mexican. My dad was born in East LA. His mother's family was from Baja California. His father's family was from a tiny town in northern New Mexico called Guadalupita. When I was growing up, my grandpa Bob would tell me about our family's Spanish history. He had grown up on a 100-acre farm in New Mexico that had come to the family via Spanish land grant. Grandpa told me we were descended from the conquistadores who had settled New Mexico in the 16th and 17th centuries. When I turned 16, Grandpa's brother presented me with a handwritten family tree. He said that the Spanish he had grown up speaking in New Mexico was closer to colonial Spanish than what was spoken in modern Latin America. He used verb tenses that were in common usage more than 400 years ago. From the family tree, I could see the names of my great-great-great-great-grandparents for the first time. There was a star next to the name of my great-great-great-grandmother, Maria Dolores Lopez, Navajo Indian. When I was in my 20s, my dad gave me a photo of Maria's daughter, Perfidia, and her husband, Casimero. Their shoulders are hunched, and they're posing with their daughter, Sarah. Sarah's hair is pulled back into two long braids, and she's wearing a thick beaded necklace. I was intrigued. I'd always assumed that our family had some Native American blood. How could we not, after so many centuries in the Southwest? And could the conquistador story be true? How much Spanish blood did we have? How much Native American? This year, my father decided to find out. He took a DNA test. The results were surprising. Dad isn't very Spanish, a mere 6%. But he is British and Cameroonian, and Irish and Italian, and even East Asian. And he's 1% Finnish. Finnish. But the biggest surprise was that Dad's really Native American, 47%. Dad shared the news with our family. My uncle, who would swear on Grandma's enchiladas that we are Spanish, chose to ignore the information. Dad's high school classmate said, "I always knew you were part European," which I think she meant as a compliment. When I shared the news with friends, more than a few suggested that I hit the jackpot. I'm really excited to learn about my family's Native American heritage, not because of imaginary casino riches, but because I now have a more complete picture of our ancestry. My family did such a good job of assimilating that we invented an alternative history. Now I can take all of those family stories and I can put them into context. And now I have a more nuanced answer to the question, what are you?
April Salazar is a writer and storyteller in New York City. And thanks to April for sharing her story. Genetic testing has gotten really big over the last few years. In fact, here at Latino USA, our entire office has talked about doing it together. Maybe someday, mis queridos. And that's it for this week, everyone. Latino USA is produced by Daisy Rosario, Lita Hartman, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Antonia Cerejido, Julia Alsop, and Sarah Barrett. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks to WBEZ in Chicago. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on my Instagram, Maria_la_Hinojosa. See you then, everyone.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
I have to go get oral surgery after this.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, supporting efforts to make education more affordable for students and flexible for teachers through open educational resources, online at hewlett.org. And Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. This is NPR.